Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The Slate Culture Gabfest is brought to you by BowlandBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BowlandBranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com, and use the promo code CULTURE. And by Roku and HBO Now. Roku players offer the biggest selection of streaming channels like HBO Now. Learn more and try HBO Now free for 1 month by going to roku.com/gab. And by ScoreBig. Did you know that 40% of all live event tickets go unsold? ScoreBig works directly with your favorite teams and artists to get those unsold seats at huge savings. Go to scorebig.com right now, click on the microphone, and enter the promo code CULTURE. You'll save an extra $20 off your first ticket purchase. That's scorebig.com, promo code CULTURE.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Men Are Still Good edition. It's Wednesday, March 30th, 2016. You hadn't heard that yet?
No.
It's a LARF. Full credit to Dana Stevens.
And Ben Affleck.
Yeah, that's true. On today's show, Marvel versus DC, Gotham versus Metropolis, and maybe, just maybe, the snobs versus the demos, Superman versus Batman. Dawn of Justice has repelled the critics and attracted massive box office. What is going on? And then Samantha Bee, the justly beloved correspondent from The Daily Show, has her own entry in the late night sweepstakes. We discuss Full Frontal, her weekly late night news satire on TBS. And finally, what is it to be a bro? We discussed the bro concept with Wesley Morris, critic at large for the New York Times. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
It's nice to be face to face.
Yeah, embodied.
I know. It's nice to be embodied. And Dana Stevens, the film critic.
Hey, Steve.
It's nice to be embodied with you too, Dana. Nice
yes,
to see you.
Head on a stick. You're in a room together.
It's been too long.
That wouldn't be embodied. That would be like and stickened.
But didn't you once accuse me of being a head on a stick, a human lollipop, as I recall?
In what context?
I don't know, talking about yoga or something. You said you just seem like a kind of person who regards himself as a head on a stick, and you were completely correct.
What a dickhead. Oh my God, really? I said that?
You said it lovingly, and I consented.
Oh, dear. Julia, we must have some business before we start.
Two pieces. The first, we have a live show, our first in a while, coming up in New York City next week. In fact, it's worth probably briefly noting here that we are taping next Wednesday, April 6th at the SVA Theater. There are still tickets available at slate.com/live. And that also means that we'll be posting the show a day late next week. So the show will go up Thursday rather than Wednesday. And then finally, for Slate Plus members, we are doing a special bonus segment today, prompted by an email we got from a listener saying, I'm going to be in New York for 24 hours. What should I do? And we emailed that listener a couple off the top of our head thoughts, but we thought we would repurpose. We would go back to that subject for our Slate Plus segment. So if you're a member, look forward to that. If you're not, you can join at slate.com/culture plus. All right, Steve, let's commence.
All right. Thanks, Julia. Moving on. Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice is the first big tentpole of the summer of 2016. It stars Henry Cavill as the Man of Steel and Ben Affleck as the Caped Crusader. Oh, I got those wrong in the run-up.
Wait, if you think we're cutting that, you're so wrong.
All right, in it goes. The movie also features Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor, Amy Adams as Lois Lane, and Jeremy Irons as Alfred the Butler. It's directed by Zack Snyder. I will not even attempt to untangle the plot. I will, however, now introduce a clip.
Next time they shine your light in the sky, don't go to it. The bat is dead. Bury it. Consider this mercy. Tell me. Do you bleed? You will.
Okay, we couldn't get through the clip without laughing. I think that signals where this is going to go. We're joined by Jamelle Bouie, who is Slate's chief political correspondent and also a bit of a comic fanboy. Yeah?
I wouldn't say fanboy. I'd say comic fan, someone who appreciates the form but have plenty of critical thoughts about it all.
Yeah, fanboy is not a term that many people claim for themselves, Steve, I don't think.
It's like hipster. Nobody wants to be one.
I wouldn't know. Okay, I'm moving right along. A lot of stupid movies, Jamelle, make a lot of money, but I don't think I've ever seen so big a discrepancy as the one here between the critics who totally pan this movie. They seem to actually take it personally and revile it, almost without exception and without qualification, in the box office for the film, which really has been enormous. Global box office already at nearing $500 million pretty quickly out of the gate. We'll get to how what box office now means in a global context. But for now, the movie was reviled and it was a hit. Surely not everyone is hate-watching this movie. Who's wrong here, the eggheads or the peuple?
I don't think the eggheads are wrong. It is a very bad movie. I think that the general public is not looking for something that's sophisticated in superhero movies, right? They want to see Batman versus Superman fight. And as long as the movie delivers that much, they're quite happy. And I mean, I have to say this does disappoint me somewhat as a fan of the characters and as kind of a longtime comic book reader. The persistent criticism of comic books and I think more or superhero comic books and more specifically the fans of superhero comic books is that they aren't actually interested in story or character. They are just indulging power fantasies and want to see sort of indiscriminate violence in service of the power fantasies. And that's what this movie is. And the massive box office total seems to suggest that at least for fans of these films, or at least the people who go to see these films, that criticism is very much true.
Mm-hmm. Although, isn't there some, maybe this is just like clutching at straws of box office hope. Doesn't this movie have an unprecedented drop off from its like Friday returns to its Sunday returns, suggesting that a lot of the people who went to see it, even the people most predisposed to like this movie, went home and tweeted all their friends, stay away, stay back.
It does. And, you know, there is some suggestion that this might look like the Green Lantern film from a couple years ago, which had a very good opening weekend and then just dropped off into oblivion as word of mouth got around that this was a bad film.
Okay, I think there's like a lot of fun meat and gristle to tear into on this one. A lot of muscly man flesh we can rend asunder when we get into the movie. Wow, that got really violent. But before we do, I think we should talk about why this is an interesting failure or an interesting discrepancy between box office and quality. Because to the uninitiated, it seems like yet another superhero movie. But what it actually marks is a bid by Time Warner, which owns the DC comic properties, to try to launch a set of superhero movie franchises that can help them equalize the Marvel universe, which between the Avengers movies, the Captain America movies, and some other set of movies, and the Iron Man movies, which are all intertwined, it's having a good run. Not to mention the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which we all liked all right. So, Jamelle, can you talk a little bit about like Marvel and DC and this rivalry and how they fared at the box office for the last, 5 to 10 years, and just like in general, like is one Coke and Pepsi? Is there like a McDonald's, Burger King, Avis Hertz dynamic between these two? Like, what's the broader macro story of these two, not Batman v Superman, but Marvel v DC going to battle, and what does this film perhaps portend?
Well, there is at times, and I think their history is there has been a bit of Coke versus Pepsi element to the Marvel versus DC rivalry. But in general, the two companies from their beginnings, DC Comics in the 1930s and 1940s, Marvel Comics in its sort of modern form, at least in the 1960s, they have stood for sort of two different kinds of superhero. DC, I think, as evidenced by kind of the mythic qualities of Superman, of Batman, of the Flash, like these sort of living gods, has always kind of put forth this kind of almost self-consciously mythic version of their superheroes, that they stand for these broad themes and these broad ideas, and they interact in a world where that's understood by everyone. Marvel, on the other hand, has traditionally portrayed heroes that are very much just people. They have like human flaws, human foibles, and that I think continues into the present day films. What stands out about the Marvel Studios movies, which are different than the Marvel property movies made by Fox, like X-Men and the Fantastic Four, or that the Marvel Studio movies are very much about these characters as people, right? So in Iron Man, in the Iron Man series, Tony Stark fights with his robotic suit, but he also deals with relationship problems and alcohol abuse and all these human qualities. And so I think part of what gives the Marvel movies their charm is exactly this, that they very much feature superheroics and, you know, massive world-scale destruction, but they're also very much about the characters themselves. That you, in Guardians of the Galaxy, you like Star-Lord and Groot and all of them, Rocket Raccoon, for who they are just as much as what they can do. And that, you know, in the handful of DC movies that have been made over the last couple of years, and I think I would include the Christopher Nolan Batman movies as well, you're watching films that are less concerned with these people, less concerned with Bruce Wayne, and more concerned with what Bruce Wayne represents. In the case of Batman versus Superman or Man of Steel, what Superman represents.
I mean, I don't know about you, Steve, but coming out of 2013 Man of Steel, I felt no need to see Henry Cavill mm-hmm. play Superman yeah. ever again. It was such a lifeless incarnation of the character, and the idea that it's being now repurposed in order to create an ATM machine for a new
exactly.
company just strikes me as bottomlessly cynical. And not to mention that Ben Affleck, the combination of Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill in this movie, okay, it's like two drains were opened at the bottom of the movie screen and all the energy just poured out. There's no moment between the two of them that has a spark of life. The only moments in the film that do have to do either with the villain Lex Luthor Jr., played I think in a very mannered but amusing way by Jesse Eisenberg, or maybe a couple of Amy Adams scenes. But these two superheroes that mm-hmm. we're supposed to be thrilled by the confrontation of are both just as boring as a sack of oats.
I couldn't agree more. And Jamel, it seems to me this movie was made under a series of constraints that were very hard to work their way out of cleverly. One was, first of all, you have to get these two people to fight. I mean, that's the, you know, premise.
Yeah, it's
upon...
not Batman ampersand Superman.
No. Right. Right. So the premise of the whole thing to cart people into the theater en masse is that you're going to see these two fight. That immediately creates all kinds of superhero problems, right? You have to create a plot that makes it convincing that they'd be somehow sufficiently enraged at each other to do that. Secondly, one has superpowers and the other doesn't. So you have to somehow right. equalize the two of them. And to hide all of these strategic necessities as plot necessities, they wrap the whole thing in ponderous theology about the nature of Superman as a quasi-god. Talk a little bit about what's uniquely awful about this movie.
Sure. I think it's worth going back to the Marvel Pictures real quick to establish the contrast. So Avengers came out in 2012, but before we got to the Avengers, we had Iron Man in 2008, Iron Man 2 in 2010, I believe, Captain America in like 2011. We had a series of films building up to the Avengers. And so by the time you got to the theaters to watch the Avengers, if you were a fan of these films, or if you're just preparing, you could watch these characters sort of develop over time. You could see Tony Stark change over time. You could meet Captain America. You had some sort of investment in all of them. And so you had some reason to want to see them get together, to want to see them act in concert. This doesn't exist in Batman versus Superman. There really is... no reason for them to be fighting within the context of the film, which is disappointing because in the kind of the universe, the history of the characters, they have fought in the past, and the reasons why their fights have held any weight whatsoever is because they had a prior relationship. They were friends. They were friends with very different ideas about what it meant to be a hero, what it meant to operate sort of a bit outside the law. And those conflicts, the fights then were vehicles for those conflicts, ways you could see these two men in their kind of style of heroism play out. And that doesn't exist in this film. It really does seem as if the studio thought, hey, we want to have Batman versus Superman fight because that just seems kind of cool. Let's figure out a way to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, the fight is the biggest problem with the movie. And the movie takes, you know, it's probably 2 hours and 20 minutes running time. It takes about 90 minutes to get to the fight. And you know that they're going to make up because it's not going to end with, like, them in conflict. And then there's to be a whole other set of fight with the actual baddie. But just to, I mean, and I think we will spoil some details about the fight. For example, spoiler, there is a fight. So if you, for some godforsaken reason, still want to see this movie unspoiled, you should fast forward about 10 minutes to the end
of
the segment.
It's just a chess game, Batman v Superman. Very collegial, very friendly.
It's actually, they play celebrity.
Pop quiz.
But no, so like, among the things about the fight is actually like a mind-bogglingly, amazingly poorly executed thing, and it's worth picking apart how horrible it is. So for one thing, they're both there as dupes. So neither of them has agency where you're rooting for them or you're excited to see them do battle, because Batman is in this movie sort of like an aging paranoiac who's like mad that there's another superhero in town, which is like not the hottest look as a set of motives. Like basically he's motivated by jealousy and a sense that he's and like a sense of impotence. So that's like gross. And then Superman is like, who's this pesky humanoid? Screw this guy. He's in my way. They set up the fight. In the fight, somehow Batman has acquired a bit of kryptonite. But rather than just using it to kill his enemy, as he would if he were really, if his heart was in it, he like somehow turns it into a kind of like aerosol spray. And so he basically like fight roofies Superman so that Superman is like diminished enough that he can prove his dominance over him. And then when he's in this fight roofied state, he fights in the most dirty, unbecoming manner that makes you basically feel like you can never respect Batman again.
He doesn't he break a porcelain bathtub over Superman's head while
sink,
he's down?
He just kind of like flips his ragdoll body around and like knocks out some pillars. It's just like disgusting.
That's all Zack Snyder too. Zack Snyder, I mean, yeah. Just to go on a brief tangent, is one of the most sadistic action filmmakers there is. He just basically wants to enjoy seeing people get wailed on and chopped.
Yeah,
to
so you're basically rooting for Batman to be a like impotent, insecure, sad sadist, or you're not. But then what are you rooting for on the other side? For like the inexorable force of like skull crushing, you know, a fist to like break the wind out of Batman's windpipe? I mean, basically by the end of that fight, I kind of am. I'm like, fuck it, kill Ben Affleck. Like, he's like such a fucking asshole.
Oh, I wanted them both to wipe each other out and to take the superhero right, so genre with them.
And then just to, I mean, I'm the Superman quality too. The other problem with this, the fight and the broader movie is, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Christopher Nolan or Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, but I can at least acknowledge that they did something kind of new, right? Like they did add this kind of somber, brooding quality. They added this level of darkness. Like there, you did feel like you were in a fully realized and somewhat interesting world. And I do think that the second one that had Heath Ledger was like a genuinely due to that performance and the resonance of that performance after Ledger's death and you know, not to undersell the rest of it. With Michael Caine and Christian Bale, like to go there for a couple movies, fine. But to then turn Superman into also a sad, brooding guy, like isn't Superman all supposed to be plucky cheer and like kind of grotesquely square bravado? And I could get that it would be hard to translate such a like square macho character for the 20 teens, but they should have tried a little harder. It seems like he was just Batman too.
Yeah, they did it for Captain America in the Marvel movies, right? He's somebody who manages to bring sort of old school pluckiness into the new superhero world and have it be an interesting tension. Yeah, right. The idea of a kind of cynical, tired Superman is just so sad and limp. Who wants to see him win any fight?
No, I mean, it feels funny to say that this is a film of like squandered opportunity, especially I think, as our listeners know, Dana and Steve and I don't necessarily relish the next superhero movie in the way that you do, although I think we've all seen some that we like and some that we haven't over the years. But yeah, there's like so many almost good things, like Amy Adams squandered as Lois Lane. The two things that made me saddest about her performance were, one, they get her like basically naked in a bathtub. I'm like, fucking Amy Adams has like an Oscar. She does not need to be naked in a bathtub for this movie. I mean, you don't see too much, but like, why'd she say yes to that? Like, this was not worth it. I mean, mm-hmm. Not that there's any shame if that's what she wants to do with her life, but like, come on, Amy. And then also, her relationship with Superman is so annoying. He keeps shooting into the sky in the middle of their fucking conversations. If I ever had a boyfriend who just would like drop a line and like be like, I'm not sure I can save the world anymore. It's like, he's just not even listening to you.
But Julia, to be fair, if you're in free fall between flight 58 and 56 and your boyfriend comes in and snags you from certain death, you'll put up with an occasional rapid absconding.
She's drawing up a pro and con list. Pro, saves me from falling buildings when I'm hurled off by supervillains. Con,
poor conversationalist, bad listening etiquette. I mean, that felt squandered. I also did, like, it's prettier than I thought compared to Zack Snyder. I decided to see a drunk on IMAX in 3D to, like, help.
Oh, yeah.
So I took wine in a thermos, and it like, it was less ugly than I thought. There's like a lot of elegantly floating particulate matter in various scenes. Oh,
but it's all that bullshit Zack Snyder slow time, yeah. You know, where the bullet has to be moving at a different speed than everyone in the background. It's just such bullshit. It's such a visual cliche. There was not one moment in this movie that was not a massive cliche.
It's phony baloney all the way through. Jamel, it was such a pleasure to have you back on the show to talk about this
travesty
of a movie and make some sense of it for us. Jamel Bowie is the chief political correspondent for Slate. Jamel, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our sponsor, Julia Turner. What do we have?
The Slate Culture Gabfest is sponsored this week by Bowl and Branch, Steve. If you want to get anything done, you have to sleep. You have to sleep well. It sucks when you don't. It sucks when you can't. And investing some time and money in making your bed an awesome thing that delights you every time you get into it at night, I think is such a good use of energy. I certainly have done so. And every time I pull my covers up, I think, They have great quality sheets. They also have an amazing policy that allows you to purchase sheets, try them, and then send them back. So you can, I mean, this is the thing that's the great risk, the great problem with buying sheets is that you could buy them and think they're the perfect ones for you. But if only you know what will make you say, So you can try them and then see if they're your bag. And I think Dana has incorporated some Bowl and Branchery into her sheet sets.
Oh, yeah. I love them. They're the all-weather sheet.
The all-weather sheet. That sounds like such a great retro slogan. It's like the Morton Salt girl should be talking about the all-weather sheet. Bowl and Branch also has a special offer for our listeners. You can get 20% off your entire order. Sheets, but not just sheets. Also towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything. Plus free shipping. Go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off the entire order. And use the promo code CULTURE. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com. Promo code CULTURE.
All right, moving on. Samantha Bee first came to public attention as a loopy but acerbic correspondent on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. It was only a matter of time before her peculiar genius for being smart while playing dumb and delivering the biting aperçu was applied to her own late-night show. It is especially timely with an avowed sexist and a confirmed woman running for president. Full Frontal, thank you, Julia. Full Frontal has been on the air for a while now. Let's assess, but first let's listen to a clip.
How does removing access to health care increase health care?
We're not removing access to health care. We're improving.
So the intention of the law was not to do away with abortions.
No.
It was just to make them impossible to acquire.
You know better than that.
What do you
mean impossible? I'll tell you what, anytime you start cutting on people's body, you need to have it in a procedure where it can be healthy.
Of course. You don't cut a woman in an abortion, though.
To be fair, Flynn grew up in ancient Westeros, where they did abortions the old-fashioned way.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know, but I listened to many doctors tell me about the procedures that happen when you do an invasive surgery.
You don't seem to know anything specifically about abortion, really, at all. And yet, you did all this with building regulations.
What?
You gotta feel bad.
We did. But you know what? I don't see any reason to go rub anything in anybody's face.
You don't need to gloat.
Yeah.
You've done enough.
There's those 8,000 bills I got to go deal with.
You've done enough.
Julia, why don't I start with you? Right off the bat, Samantha Bee's terrifically funny. She's tweaked the format. There's no desk. She comes out, she stands. Of course, she's not the first woman to have a late night
show. She's like the third.
Yeah, she's like second or third, whatever. Joan Rivers, obviously. First one to have it in the satirical news format, to have a Daily Show-like show of her own. She well earned it. What do you make about it so far?
Well, sometimes I think this whole episode could be called the expectations game. Like, I'd heard such terrible things about Batman v Superman that I spent the whole movie being like, this is like only as bad as Iron Man 2. Like, this is terrible, but not like world historically terrible. And similarly, and unfairly for poor Sam B, I'd heard all of these burblings of like, this is the second coming. They should have given the Daily Show to her. It's like Trevor Noah stole it from Sam B. She's incredible. She's John Oliver twice over. Oh my God. Like, which is nobody's fault but my own or whatever for waiting to watch it so late. It's good. It's good. She's funny. It's not like so good that you should reallocate your schedules and lives to make sure you never miss a minute of it. But if you like watching this kind of show, you should definitely be watching this one of this kind of show, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, it didn't feel like despite the fact that she stands energetically and delivers essentially a half hour long monologue punctuated with video set pieces as opposed to sitting and having the guest rigmarole, it's like another good one of the shows. That was my response. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry that that's so tempered in equivocation and expectation.
But you stole my lack of thunder. I have to say that was exactly how I felt about it. Dana, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think some of the things that she does to shake up the format, while appreciated, also need a little bit of tweaking. It's early in the show and it could go lots of ways. I hope it lasts long enough to go different ways. But choosing not to have a desk and not to have a guest each week also means that the entire show is Sam B. And there's a lot of Sam B standing, you know, wearing a black suit on a white stage talking to an audience. And I felt like the show needed to be broken up with some more thematic segments. There are some reported segments in the manner of the old Daily Show correspondent pieces where there are these sort of faux interviews with people who don't quite understand they're being interviewed for a comedy show. But it's always Sam B who's doing them. So to me, it felt a little bit like it needed tonal variation throughout the half hour. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that does feel fresh about it is just the sheer fact of it being a woman. And that sounds boring in a way. But there's a segment she does about untested rape kits and the travesty of the fact that it takes an incredibly long time for these things to get tested, that in fact some states destroy them, that is one of those like long running and ignored travesties of the American criminal justice system that just is like a drone that's been underpinning criminal justice for decades and so nobody can hear it anymore. And I don't think it's an accident that it was her show that was like, you know what, let's actually highlight this and hold this up for review and criticism. And I doubt that any of the sort of satiric news shows ignored the Supreme Court oral arguments around the Texas abortion case and revisiting the notion of undue burden. So I don't think the fact that she did a segment with a Texas abortion doctor has to do with her gender particularly, but her angle on it is different and does feel fresh and feels valuable and useful mm-hmm. to have someone who's making those jokes from that perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's in one of the episodes I saw, it was the one right after the most preposterous of the Republican debates, in which the, you know, endowment of Donald Trump was one of the topics. But in general, the debate was nothing but crosstalk and yelling and completely ridiculous displays of juvenile upmanship. And they cut back to Samantha Bee after she's shown a clip from this. And she says, I don't mean to sound sexist, but I think men are just too emotional to be president. And from her, that's just a terrific line. No one else can deliver it in that business the way she can. I agree with you almost down the line, Julia. I would say that my first reaction to seeing a couple of these is that she probably should have gotten The Daily Show. It would have been a great move on their part. But also, I had a second reaction. Dana, I'm curious to know whether you share this at all. I may have reached my limit for let them eat satire. The debasement of the culture as, and especially the political culture, as raw material for the late night shows, and this is the kind of comedy placebo that I swallow on a nightly basis to wake up, you know, as a functionally sane human being, I've kind of reached the end of it in a weird way. I want rage and political action. I don't want to laugh, however on point the satire is.
Yeah, that's maybe, I think it is possible that our whole culture has reached that point in the sense that that desire to have a nightly place to laugh at the political absurdities of the day has dispersed into all these little niche markets, right? And you can go here for a taste of this style of it and there for a taste of another style of it. And the idea that that's sort of a institution that we return to, as in the old Daily Show days, may be gone. But I don't think it's going to be gone in the way that you might prefer, where all of these shows simply disappear from the landscape. I mean, to me, John Oliver is now mm-hmm. filling that space yeah. in his weekly show. And my theory about why she didn't do the Daily Show is maybe she was offered it and she didn't take it. I mean, this is once a week, half an hour. That's every single night for half an hour. And Samantha Bee's a mother, and maybe she didn't want her entire life to be taken over by the daily production of television.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, I don't actually think there's been clear reporting around what the rationale or line of thinking or, you know, order of offers was at Comedy Central, although it might be telling that Zambi's weekly show isn't at Comedy Central. But I also think it's interesting that her gender is still so much of a factor that we sort of think, oh, she's a mom. Maybe she wants to do a weekly show. I mean, not that that's not an unreasonable factor, but like, why shouldn't any of these people who are dads or just people who like their yoga classes want to have a weekly show instead of a daily show if you can get the economics of it right? I mean, I do. It is one of those things where it both seems, it's crazy how crazy it is. It's crazy how rare it is. And it's valuable to have her voice there, even though it does not feel like in 2016, it should be novel or surprising to have a woman just talk for half an hour. And I kind of like that. I like that she's not like, let me interrupt my voice with some other voices. I like that she's just like, fucking listen to me. Fucking listen to me for half an hour. I'm not sure I'm going to, but I like that that's what she wants.
All right. Well, I think on that note, we can leave it there. The show is Full Frontal. It stars Samantha Bee, late of The Daily Show. Tell us what you think of Full Frontal, whether you like it, whether you think she's keeping pace or exceeding Trevor Noah and John Oliver. All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our other sponsor, Julia Turner. What do we have?
The Slate Culture Gabfest is also sponsored today by Roku and HBO. Roku players give you the biggest selection of streaming channels like HBO Now, plus innovative features like voice search, unbiased search results, and private listening via the Roku remote or your mobile app. And with HBO Now, you get all of HBO, including every season, every episode of HBO's addictive original series, past and present, plus the biggest and latest movies before any other streaming service. No TV package required. I will say, we just set up a Roku a couple months ago, and it's so great and so easy. I did, full disclosure, make my husband do it, but it seemed like it was easy for him. And I use it all the time, particularly when we're prepping for this show. My Monday night TV viewing was often a like sad scramble of me watching something on a tiny screen because I just couldn't do the math of how to get the streaming service to cooperate with the TiVo. And Roku has made that much easier and made it much easier for me to watch exactly what I want to watch, exactly where I want to watch it. You can try HBO Now free for 1 month. Visit roku.com/gab to learn more about Roku players and to get your 1 month free HBO Now trial.
All right, moving on. Wesley Morris is critic at large for The New York Times and a contributor to The Times Magazine. His essay, Broliferation, he writes, courtesy of Jersey Shore, the bro became evidence of ridiculous male friendship, like the bond among veterans, but with self-tanner instead of casualties of war. He ends it on a wonderful note. He says, bro puts a dunce cap on patriarchy. Wesley Morris, welcome back to the show to talk to us about bros.
Thank you for having me.
Wesley, why don't we dive right in? Just go ahead and define a bro for us.
I mean, loosely, it is a person primarily fond of using the word bro while also being the sort of person who might wear what we would now call athleisure, but at the time didn't have such a name.
I'm not sure I would give it that name now, but continue.
Right. I mean, loosely also defined as athleisure. You know, the stereotypical bro is a guy in either boat shoes or sneakers, shorts, sweatpants, cap, sunglasses somewhere on his face, but not his eyes, or his head, but not his
Could
eyes.
Could it be a lanyard around his neck or pushed up on the forehead?
Pushed up on the forehead is more typical. Like, even worn on the shirt collar is fine, although I sometimes do that. I think bro is culturally white, but I know bros of all races. But, you know, there's a kind of cultural, the thing that sort of most defines a bro is a kind of affinity for or comfort with using that word on all people. You know, a word that was typically defined, like a word that began as a truncated version of brother, used by black people to black men, somewhat fraternally, but also politically, to sort of identify black men in white spaces or, you know, out in public as being seen by other black people. What else do we have here?
I mean, the thing that your piece puts its finger on so beautifully, and that I hadn't quite examined myself, but that is confusing about how we use bro now, is that bro seems to upend a power structure in a good way by giving us all a way to make fun of white guys. I mean, right. Basically, a bro, when you say bro, essentially the image is frat guy.
Yes.
And, or like when I think of my prep school upbringing, we call them the cap crew. It's like the guys who wore the, you know, the varsity hats,
yes,
backwards.
Yes,
it's
yes,
like
yes.
That, there's a straight line, right? So it's the dudes of, you know, athletic white dudes of the sort who have typically been powerful in the culture. So it's like, okay, here's a way to sneer at all of you. And sneering's never fun, but it's fun to have a way to sneer at the people who don't usually get sneered at. On the other hand, it feels like there's this racial appropriation in it, where this term that had one valence within the black community and has been used widely there for years suddenly has become a way that, like, white guys talk about other white guys lovingly, and then the rest of the culture makes fun of them. So that seems confusing. There's like a gender upset and a racial appropriation happening at the same time.
Right. I think the thing that I lament is that, like all things, I think the thing with language in general is that once people become aware that a word is a thing and it's, you know, in the sort of linguistic marketplace, so to speak, it then becomes appropriable, right? Like anybody can use it. I don't like it when people call me bro, but I understand the inevitability of no longer being able to retain its exclusivity, right? I accept that there's a kind of open sourceness with all cultures, especially blackness. And you just kind of have to cede you have to give up the program. And you can hold on to it in other ways, but it always will change and people will always find ways to hack into it. But the thing about bro to me as a pejorative is that it leaves men, and particularly white men, at a weird loss, right? Because there's nothing inherently wrong with men being friends with each other, I don't think. And I think there's a way that we're sort of writing off what, to me, especially if you watch The Jersey Shore, or, you know, there are any men in your life or near your life who get great pleasure from being around each other. I'm not happy with the dismissal of that bond. The problem, of course, is that there's a performative aspect to that bond that then becomes a problem. And that's when you get into this, what for me is a cultural bro issue.
Mm-hmm.
When the broness becomes a way to suppress, explain, condescend, block, you know, BLOC around a particular idea or person, in this case, Bernie Sanders. But, you know, it's tough for me because it's both a problem in one direction and a problem in a different direction.
Well, it's almost as if as male intimacy increases, heteronormativity has to increase correspondingly along with it in order to keep heterosexual men bonding intensively with one another, comfortable with their masculinity, against the background of a generally troubled era for male, you know, identity.
Right. Yes.
And so it may have an internal warmth and power of bonding that's quite admirable, but it may imply exclusions and, you know, and judgments that are unsavory, right?
Agreed. But I do think that we just have to come up with some better terms for some of this stuff. And we have them, right? There are useful things like asshole. You know, that really gets the job done when you're talking about groups of people who behave in a certain way toward other people.
Mm-hmm.
But you make a distinction between what you call the classic bro and then the newer pejorative usage of bro.
Yes.
For example, the Bernie bro that
right.
you just made reference to. So do you feel like there was a lost utopia of brodom that we've turned from somehow?
Oh, I think we're post-lapsarian on that one. I think that unless we can come up with other terms to apply to people like a Bernie bro. But, you know, bro is now affixable to anything. I mean, there's science bros or bro science, which are the guys who, you know, the CrossFit guys who might do CrossFit, but really believe that the science around what working out can do for your body is bogus. I can't explain it, Julia. I know you're going to want a better explanation, but I'm not going to be able to give it to you.
Okay.
But bro science has something to do with physical fitness and the body and like just being super ripped and not caring about the fact that, for instance, a lot of those drugs aren't FDA approved. Pick something you don't like and attach bro to it.
Well, what
and
about
it's a thing.
Could you be a Hillary bro?
I don't know what that even would look like.
People could have seen Wesley's face.
We need a gif of that face. Yeah. That was like the face of like taking a breath. Like,
I think blew your mind, huh?
Yeah, I don't know how that would work. I mean, we could sit here and define what a Hillary bro might be. But I mean,
Hillary's problem is that she doesn't have any bros.
If she had some bros, she wouldn't be in this mess.
Let's hashtag this. Yeah.
I mean, here's one thing that I wonder about. It seems like bro as a form of address remains in somewhat wide use, or at
wide
least
wide as possible use.
I mean, it's now that you've written an essay about it in the Times, it'll probably wane.
Yeah, but I killed it. I don't think so. I mean, I hear it every single day, many times a day.
Right,
people, my friend who lives upstairs from me, a white woman in our age area, calls me bro.
Whoa.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I'm never going to tell. I mean, it doesn't like make my blood pressure go up the way it does with most people. But yeah, she uses it. Everybody uses it. I have a bunch of kids on the subway today broing each other, like black and Hispanic kids.
So bro is a form of address, both, you know, across cultures, seems like it continues to exist. But nobody self-identifies as bro
no.
the noun.
Exactly.
Like bro the noun is only a pejorative you apply to another group.
Well, the thing that I bring up in the piece is the Rob Gronkowski party ship. Rob Gronkowski, tight end for the New England Patriots, had a big party on a big Norwegian cruise line ship.
You got to say the name of it. The Gronk Express? What was it called?
It's the Gronk's party boat.
Yeah.
Or party ship, sorry. Gronk's party ship. And it invited people, you know, bring your babes and your bros. I mean, there is,
oh, right,
you
okay.
know, what are you doing tonight? I'm going out with my bros. But if you wanted, if you know, what are you, in the same way that you wouldn't self-identify as a hipster, you also wouldn't self-identify
yeah,
as a
bro. Yeah, like that's still relational. It's like my bros. You would never be like, I bro.
Right. As a bro, let me tell you.
Yeah.
You know, no, nobody would do that. I think the only thing left to where that's applicable for me, and it's a term I hate, but people still identify this way, is foodie. I know that we've gone off to some other planet with this, but that's the only self-identification that to me is kind of pejorative, that people don't understand as pejorative and still use to explain their relationship to a certain kind of dining.
That's why foodies are worse than bros.
Yes, they are worse than bros. Foodies are the worst. They are the worst. Because they don't even like food. They like taking pictures of food and saying they checked in at a place that serves food. And they got through a line at a food place.
I mean, it's true. Of all of the things to disparage, the relational bro, the me and my buds of it, it's not the worst thing in the world for those people within their relationships with one another. Obviously, it can sometimes reflect outward towards women or people of other classes or ethnic groups in ways that are unappealing. But the inner like bro as endearment is like sort of uncorrupted.
I mean, yeah, I think a lot of us know people who at least in some ways have some attachment to men in a way that if, you know, Dana and Julia were out, be like, those dudes are bros. And then you turn around and one of those guys is your husband or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just, could you imagine?
It's fun to think of our particular spouses just like broing down
just
together out there with some bros.
But there's a way in which I've heard women sort of talk about not necessarily identifying men as bro in the way we defined it at the top of the segment, but as feeling that there's a way that men talk to each other when they don't care whether or not anybody is listening, that feels exclusionary of them, that they, the only word they can come up with because it's the least offensive word is bro. Like, this isn't misogyny, this isn't sexism mm-hmm. or chauvinism. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a,
yeah,
like, oblivious male camaraderie that women find annoying.
But what can I just stand up somewhat as an excluded woman from brodom to say, I sensed the urge for some kind of lost utopia in your piece when you talk about how difficult it is for men to, or as mm-hmm. Steve just said, for yeah. men to find an identity for themselves right now.
Right.
Right. I mean, are we really going to say that Taylor Swift can have her squad goals and her, you know, girl friendships, and that there's not any space for men to have friendships that maybe do exclude women in a non-misogynistic
right.
way? Just this guy
is,
stuff? Guy
this
stuff.
Is, right. This is what I'm, this is, yes, that is gone. Milton, it's over.
I'm feeling the urge to brosplain the piece to its author right now. So how about this as a distinction? To the extent that a man and a group of friends, male friends, are aware of the fact that we live in a time of unique masculine insecurity, and they don't experience this bitterly as a loss for which they need to compensate for, but nonetheless enacting this destabilization, they then inhabit the role of man with a degree of, like, you know, self-consciousness, bro is okay. To the extent that they are using it to compensate for things they find threatening about feminism and
yeah.
the loss of masculine, especially white masculine prerogative, it's repulsive.
I think you just described Batman versus Superman. I think that is that movie in a very well done sentence, Steve.
Well, as Ben Affleck intones through his filter at one point, men are still good.
It's true. It's true. It's true.
All right, well, Wesley, always, it's such a huge pleasure to have you on the show. It was great to have you back, bro.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it was.
The look. That was so good.
I got the look, man. Do not call me bro, says Wesley Morris to Steve Metcalf.
I'm not your bro, dude.
Apparently. All right. Thanks so much for coming on. That was great.
Always.
All right. Now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our other sponsor, Julia Turner. What do we have?
We have a new sponsor this week, Steve. It's ScoreBig.com, which is an online ticket reseller with a difference. ScoreBig works directly with your favorite teams and artists to get their unsold tickets at unpublished prices. And they have a couple of cool features that you might not find elsewhere on the web. The first is that all of the fees and shipping costs are built in, so you won't have the experience of clicking around and looking through the exact seat map of the stadium or arena or theater you want to go to and picking the perfect set of seats that's at the absolute maximum of what you've decided you want to pay to go to the thing, and then hitting purchase and being like, oh, fuck, there's an extra like $100 I wasn't factoring in. I have to go back and do the whole thing again. So they build in the costs, which is nice when you're trying to figure out what you actually want to spend. And then also for certain events, they have a feature called Name a Ticket Price. So if you just want to go, you know, I think probably this summer we'll take our kids to their first baseball game. They've started to get interested in baseball as a concept. You could sort of pick a game that you want to go to, pick how much you want to pay for the seats. If you're taking three-year-olds to a baseball game for the first time, you're probably really only going to go for like four innings and a hot dog and get out of there. So you don't really want to pay premium rates for premium seats. And the service will find you some seats at the price you want to pay. So next time you go see any game or show, go to ScoreBig first and see how much you can save. Go to scorebig.com right now. Click on the microphone, enter promo code CULTURE, and you'll save an extra $20 off your first purchase. That's scorebig.com, promo code CULTURE for $20 off whatever you buy.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you have?
This week, I'm going to endorse another podcast that's on Slate and on Panoply, but I swear there's no payola involved. It is truly a wonderful podcast, and I'm so excited. It's back. It's June Thomas's podcast on The Americans. Have you guys been listening, and do you watch The Americans?
I've, like, fallen fatally behind in The Americans. I'm going to watch The Americans in, like, 2024, and then I'll listen to June's podcast then, too.
Oh, my God. It's so good. Steve, do you watch The Americans?
I do. I'm catching up, though. I'm behind.
To me, it's one of the few appointment viewings of the week. And what June is doing on this podcast is very different from your average sort of let's discuss what happened on the episode podcast. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's kind of what we do here. But hers is actually an insider's Workings of the Show podcast. And so every week she talks to Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, who are the co-creators and showrunners of the show, plus whoever else she could get on. She had Carrie Russell and Matthew Reese for the first episode. And on the second episode for this season, because there have now been two new episodes of The Americans this season, she got this guy who was an actual operative in the style of their characters on the show. An East German who was conscripted by the Stasi to pose as an American and who has some actual stories that relate to things that are happening on the show. And he's an amazing storyteller. And June is just the best interviewer. I'm sure if you listen to this podcast, you're in love with June Thomas. So if you want to hear her dig into what I think is one of the best shows on TV right now, Slate's The Americans podcast posts every week after the show airs on Wednesday.
Cool. Julia, what do you have?
I just want to follow that up by saying that one of my favorite June Thomas podcast experiences is actually a Slate Plus members only perk, which has concluded forever. So it's really good. I'm shouting it out now. But she and Seth Stevenson did this joint podcast for Downton Abbey for the last few seasons, including the final season, which just concluded a couple weeks ago. And I stopped watching Downton Abbey as soon as the guy died, like in season two or whatever. But I've been listening to them consistently throughout and just following it exclusively as a podcast. And it's delightful. And if you think that show is preposterous and basically worthless, but still entertaining, it's a great way to experience it. So just skip the end of Downton, but listen to June and Seth on Slate Plus. All right, guys, I got nothing here. I'm going to endorse my favorite yogurt.
It's culture.
That's like the corniest joke you've made in 8 years, Dana. I've like never heard you make a joke that lame in my life. That's awesome.
Inspired by your endorsement.
Fantastic. Okay, yogurt's delicious, but often it's too sweet if you get the flavored kind, right? It's got like so much syrupy gloop in the bottom. Also, I definitely don't like yogurt that has a separate strata of gloop that you have to stir in. I find that really icky, those weirdly slimy bits of former fruit.
I, in general, don't like foods that are packaged with a flavor packet that comes separately that you mix in to add flavor to it. That is just a disgusting concept.
There's something about that particular, like, sugar sludge at the bottom of certain yogurts that I find just abhorrent. Like, if forced to eat one on a plane, I'll just eat the cream off the top and then, like, discard. So, in general, I prefer my yogurts pre-blended and not too sweet. And I have become, of late, a very deep and ardent fan of Sigis yogurt or Siggy's yogurt. It's like Icelandic, but made in New Jersey. Whatever. It's one of the yogurt charlatans of the day that pretends to be an edifying foreign yogurt. But their yogurt is lower sugar generally. Like, it has less sugar per, you know, 4 ounce serving or whatever than the other ones. And they have one flavor, orange ginger, which I love, because why not have ginger in it? I would like just add ginger to all foods ever. And ginger yogurt, like, nobody makes it, but they make this amazing ginger flavor. And then the orange is just kind of like a light sort of tangy citrusy zest. So it's actually, the additive isn't sweetening. And there's like little bits of pulpy kind of orange rind and ginger in it. There's like little nubs in it, but there's not a slurry of sweet. So Sigis orange ginger yogurt. You asked, I answered. That's what I'm endorsing this week. Sorry, but it's delicious, so you're welcome as well.
How am I ever going to follow that? I mean, I can't clear that bar.
It's so low. Yeah. Your limbo skills
yes, exactly.
are lacking.
All right, well, I'm going to endorse an album by the band Echo and the Bunnymen, who
yes.
I previously have, you know, gone on about on the show, but I really only know them from their first, you know, iteration when they broke in the 80s up through, I don't know, the first four whatever records they made in the 80s, maybe early 90s. But then in 97, I think it was, no, 99, I see here, they came out with a record called What Are You Going to Do With Your Life, which it just seems to me it's a very hard target to hit, which is, you've had your first blush of success. You've been the band. You've been these, you know, whippet thin guys in super skinny pants, you know, and now you're like, you're in mid career. Where do you go? Do you like try to act like teenagers for the rest of your life? Do you become bitter about the music business and about having been marketed as a product and write vitriol songs that are thinly veiled vitriol? Well, this record, it's an amazing record. It's similar to their earlier material, but it's mellowed so perfectly and so appropriately. And there's just this tone, which you wouldn't call their natural tone. You wouldn't have said this was the natural progression for Echo and the Bunnymen, but like kind of self-elegy a little bit, like things soften into something else, maybe even entirely, but they're more beautiful for it. It's like this, the tone of the record is so perfect. It shocked me. And I think the songwriting is equivalently high to their early stuff. I mean, you know, obviously nothing replaces Killing Moon and, you know, material from that part of their career, but it's a lovely record. I really was bowled over by it.
That sounds great.
I didn't know that you were an Echo fan.
I'm not. I just faked that completely.
Bro. Oh, you broed me. All right. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Ann Hepperman. Our intern is Lindsay Albrecht. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply, the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network as well, just as Andy Bowers is. Check out our entire, I've never noticed that before. Check out our entire roster on itunes.com/panoply. That word once again is Panoply. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner, Dana Stevens, and the entire Panoply Network, I'm Steve Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Find you now, what I need then. I'd wonder how, not wonder when. Something going wrong again.